It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers and state economic development leaders are in Hessen, Germany, on a European trade mission to promote exports and international investments in Wisconsin.
In 2023, Wisconsin exported nearly $1 billion in goods to Germany. This trade mission comes as President Trump issued sweeping tariffs yesterday, including 20% on the European Union.
We have Missy Hughes, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Secretary Hughes, thanks for joining us today from Germany.
Hi, good morning or good afternoon, as it is here in Germany.
We'll take either or. We're going to get to tariffs in a moment, but how would you describe Wisconsin's economic relationship with Germany, more than 4,000 miles apart?
Well, we have an incredibly strong relationship. We have German companies that have invested in Wisconsin. And of course, we have many Wisconsin businesses that are doing business here in Germany. And so as we come here to Hessen, our goal is to really continue to strengthen that economic and cultural relationship that next year we'll be celebrating 50 years of our sister state relationship.
What types of goods are moving between Wisconsin and Germany?
Well, you see a lot of dairy industry, processing equipment, industrial machinery, electrical machinery going in both directions. And we have companies like Kronos and Velo that have invested in Wisconsin heavily. So one of the things we really try to do when we go on our trade missions is to visit companies that have already invested in Wisconsin. We make a connection and we talk to them about opportunities and make sure if they're facing any difficulties, we can help solve them.
Hessen is a central state in Germany, I understand. Why does Wisconsin have this long relationship with Hessen versus other parts of the country?
Well, some statistics say that over 40% of Wisconsinites have a relationship to Germany, whether it's, you know, an ancestral relationship or a business relationship. And when you look at the state of Hessen, we're really a lot alike. There's manufacturing, there's agriculture, there's, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship happening. So there's really lots of shared values and connections that we continue to develop year over year.
And your agency runs these global trade missions throughout the year to other parts of the globe, like Australia and Mexico and China. Governor Evers is with you in Germany on this mission, I understand. Is this particular one more important than others?
Well, they're all equally important to our businesses. We bring businesses along on these trade missions and we set up meetings for them. So we really try to smooth the path for them to be able to explore the global marketplace. And as I said, you know, one of the goals is also to visit companies that have invested in Wisconsin. And with Governor Evers, we're able to really go to these companies and say, thank you so much for being partners with us.
Your trade mission is coming as President Trump has announced import taxes ranging from 10% to 49% on goods shipped to the U.S. And let's hear President Trump announcing these tariffs yesterday.
Jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country, and you see it happening already. We will supercharge our domestic industrial base. We will pry open foreign markets and break down foreign trade barriers. And ultimately, more production at home will mean stronger competition and lower prices for consumers.
Secretary Hughes, there's a new 20% tariff on the European Union. What effect could these tariffs have on the negotiations and the meetings you're having in Germany?
Well, the tariffs have been a huge topic of conversation even before last night's announcement. You know, the up and down, the on and off of the tariffs has really caused a lot of uncertainty and frankly, disappointment from the conversations that we've had with Germans about the turn of events and the turn in the relationship. And there's a lot of feeling that we had a good relationship and we've had for many, many years a excellent relationship across Europe and real confusion about why things have changed. For businesses and for our businesses, it brings unpredictability, it brings instability, and that's frustrating. Our businesses that are with us really want to explore the global marketplace and see lots of opportunity, and they see the tariffs as a potential obstacle to that chance.
And I wanted some clarity here. Are your meetings in country about establishing new business and closing deals, or is it more to educate and pitch about what Wisconsin could offer German firms?
Well, for our businesses that we bring on the trade mission, of course, they hope to come home with a purchase order or a real opportunity. But often it's about that first step in creating relationships. Our businesses will visit distributors or other types of marketers and, you know, make that opportunity to offer what their products are and then hopefully develop that relationship. But surprisingly enough, often our businesses are coming back with purchase orders and with real concrete deals. For us, as we're talking to businesses who have already invested in Wisconsin, it's an opportunity to shake hands and to introduce ourselves so they know they have a partner on the other side of the pond in government who's ready to help them with any issues they might have, or any opportunities they might think about for expanding or doing more in Wisconsin.
We're talking about trade relationships with Wisconsin's sister state of Hessen, Germany, and a trade mission that is underway. We're reaching Missy Hughes, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation in Germany. Secretary Hughes, President Trump has said that these tariffs are necessary to counter trade barriers that other countries are imposing on the U.S. Has Wisconsin encountered significant trade barriers before these sweeping tariffs?
You know, Wisconsin, like many other states, has really taken advantage of the free trade, especially across the Mexican border and the Canadian border. We have products that move to Mexico. They have added value in Mexico, and then they come back across the border. And so what the conversations I've had with our businesses is real concern about what the impact of these tariffs will have on that really streamlined supply chain that they've created. And they really are not looking forward to disrupted supply chains and added costs, because again, that just adds instability and risk into their businesses that otherwise they were really, you know, growing and excited about the future. And this has had a real chilling effect on some of those prospects.
So if supply chains do change radically, if companies say, yes, we're going to start onshoring our manufacturing due to the pressure from these tariffs, is Wisconsin ready to get companies up and running fast with their production lines, regardless of the industry?
Well, we had already seen a fair amount of onshoring happening both post-COVID and because of a lot of the Buy America provisions that we saw in the Inflation Reduction Act and during the Biden administration. So, you know, we had a lot of positive momentum, and I think that's really the concern is that positive momentum going to be stalled because not only the tariffs, but also fears of a recession. We just heard at the top of the hour that the stock market is down 1,400 points. You know, here in Germany, a lot of the conversation has been a fear of recession, fear of a real slowdown. And when you look at a state like Wisconsin, we produce big pieces of machinery. We produce big investments for companies. And so, you know, the fear is that everyone will slow down on those investments and we'll see pain in Wisconsin's manufacturers because of that slowdown.
And not to mention, Germany is a global manufacturing powerhouse. I mean, and this trade mission is overlapping with the largest industrial technology trade show, which is, you know, held each year in Hanover, Germany. Can you talk a little bit about the potential with manufacturing and what you're seeing there?
Yeah, we had a chance to visit the Hanover Messe trade show, which, as you said, is the largest, one of the largest industrial and advanced manufacturing shows in the world. The advanced manufacturing that we saw, robotics and using artificial intelligence on the factory floor, was really incredible. And there's so much opportunity in this moment to be exploring those real innovations and those real cutting edge technologies. And that's one of the reasons we were here, to be able to see what is happening and to see how companies like
You're breaking up just a bit. I think you were going to say Rockwell Automation. I'm not sure, though. Can you still hear us?
I can. I'm sorry. We must have dropped there for a second.
That's okay. That's okay. Yes, you were talking about this trade show and what you're seeing and the synergies.
Oh, I apologize. Just really cutting edge technology, what we saw when it came to robotics and artificial intelligence, just really offers opportunity for continued investment in innovation, continued investment in research. And, you know, we hope that we can continue to see Wisconsin's companies really prosper from this new technology that we're seeing.
As we are seeing sweeping changes here with the economic front and with tariffs, what will WEDC as an agency be doing differently as it works with Wisconsin companies, especially companies that are working with overseas clients?
Well, we'll continue to work with our companies first on an information basis. You know, as things have been really changing on a daily basis, it's been hard to provide good, solid paths forward for our businesses. But as we see these things lock into place and understand what the impacts are, then we can help our companies explore new opportunities and understand the risk and how to mitigate the risks.
Secretary Hughes, thank you for joining us. Safe travels.
Thank you.
That was Missy Hughes, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We talked about trade relationships with Wisconsin's sister state of Hessen, Germany, and how the WEDC is responding to the new sweeping tariffs implemented by the Trump administration yesterday.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, visit two small Wisconsin cities that are looking to boost sustainability and cut back on greenhouse gas emissions.
As of March 2025, all of our municipal operations are now powered by 100% renewable electricity.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some Wisconsin municipalities are taking environmental sustainability into their own hands.
Sun Prairie near Madison announced it is the first city in the state to reach 100% renewable electricity for all city operations.
And on the Illinois border, the city of Beloit is taking public input now for its own climate action plan.
A few Wisconsin cities already have climate action plans in place, and we're checking in on what municipalities can do at the local level to deal with climate change.
We'll start in Sun Prairie with Rose Daly, the Sustainability and Resilience Manager. Rose, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Sun Prairie, 100% renewable electricity for all city operations on a practical level. What does that mean? What does it look like?
Yeah, great question. So as of March 2025, all of our municipal operations are now powered by 100% renewable electricity. So this includes all of the streetlights in the city, all of our traffic lights, all of our well pumps that we use to deliver drinking water to homes and businesses, all of the city-owned EV charging stations, and then all of our city facilities as well. So this includes the public library, city hall, our fire station, and the entire wastewater treatment plant.
And what renewables are in the mix here?
We have a mix of solar power, wind power, and biogas.
Now, what did it take to get from point A to point B? First of all, just to, as far as the decision-making and planning process, what went into making this a reality?
Yeah, so this was a goal that the Sun Prairie Common Council set back in 2022. They wanted us to be one of the first cities in the state to achieve 100% renewable electricity. So that was the goal they set. And then staff essentially had about 3 years to figure out how to make that goal a reality. So we really took a three-step approach to achieving this goal. So I know when people hear the word renewable electricity, the first thing they think of is installing solar panels or other clean energy sources onto your facilities. But actually, the first thing that you should focus on is minimizing your electricity consumption, because then that will help to minimize the quantity of renewables that you actually need to invest in. So we spent quite a while on energy efficiency measures in the city. So we did a full LED swap in all of our buildings. We retrofitted all of the streetlights to be LEDs. We swapped out heating and cooling systems for heat pumps and more energy efficient systems. We swapped out our water heaters, our dehumidifiers. We did improvements to windows and doors. Essentially, we just did as many energy efficiency upgrades as we could to bring down our electricity consumption. So that was the first step. And I will say that this step is really critical. We actually saw our electricity bills drop by $40,000 between the years 2023 and 2024. And those savings are dollars you can then invest into renewables. And that is step two that we followed. And that was installing in-house renewable energy systems. So we did deploy a total of 591 kilowatts of solar on roofs of city facilities, as well as some ground-mounted systems. And then our third step was to offset the remaining grid electricity that we couldn't offset with our own in-house systems. So we did purchase renewable energy blocks from our power provider, and that is what brought us to the finish line of achieving 100% renewable electricity.
For the motivation, when people were coming up with this idea, was it, hey, this is a climate measure? Was it, hey, this is a long-term cost-saving measure? What was the mix of what people were trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, it was a mix of both. So back in 2019, that is when our council first established sustainability as a citywide priority. So we, of course, wanted to reduce our contribution to greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. But then also, whenever you are doing sustainability efforts, there's typically a dollar savings tied to it. So that was also a big motivator for the city.
Is this something where you were in touch with the public and kind of selling these ideas and getting ideas, for that matter, from the local community?
Yeah, we were. We definitely wanted to have community support when we were first establishing these goals because they're ambitious. So we wanted to make sure that our community was on board with them and willing to work with us as we kind of were rushing toward this goal in 2025. But overall, the community has been very supportive of this transition to renewable electricity. And I will say that our community is just as excited about clean energy as we are. There's actually just over 300 homes and businesses throughout our city that have also invested in their own solar arrays.
We're talking about Sun Prairie reaching 100% renewable electricity for city operations. Our guest is the city's sustainability and resilience manager, Rose Daly. I understand Sun Prairie now is developing a climate action plan, maybe a follow-up to the work you've already done. What is that process looking like?
Yeah, this is definitely the next big step for us. Achieving 100% renewable electricity was a huge milestone, but we still have a lot more work to do. So the process we're taking to establish a climate action plan is step one, we need to understand our baseline. So we have to truly take the time to understand how many emissions we produce in the city as a whole. So we're currently developing greenhouse gas emission inventories for the whole city. Our second step after really understanding what our emission levels are at is to set science-based targets for emission reductions. And those targets are really important because we're going to be developing a plan and we have to understand what goals we're trying to achieve through this plan. So we're going to be setting both a 2030 and 2050 emission reduction goals. To make sure our city efforts stay aligned with the Paris Climate Agreement, our 2030 emission reduction goal is going to be around 60%. And then we'll have a full carbon neutrality goal for 2050. And then the third step is once we write those goals, we then actually have to develop a 25-year comprehensive plan that will detail all the steps the city has to take to reach those goals.
And you're mentioning emissions, and you've been careful to point out this 100% is electricity, not total energy use. So what kind of things are you targeting, or at least looking into targeting at this stage, when it comes to other energy sources and other sources of emissions?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So although we've offset our electricity use, we have not offset our natural gas use. So one thing we can do to kind of reduce natural gas use is to focus on electrifying our facilities and our vehicles. So that's going to be a really big part of our climate action plan. A really great way to electrify buildings is to install heat pump or geothermal systems. That way you can do heating and cooling off of electricity. We're going to be focusing on that. And then in addition to that, our climate action plan will also include carbon sequestration efforts using our natural environment. So growing our tree canopy, adding additional green spaces to the city. And then one more big goal we have for the climate action plan is focusing on denser development in our city. This is one that oftentimes feels slightly removed from climate action. But if we have denser development, we have more homes in our downtown, and we have more businesses all in a closer area, then our residents will be more incentivized to bike, walk, or take public transit to get around compared to taking a personal vehicle.
If people are listening elsewhere in the state thinking, yeah, I'd love to have some kind of action like this in my community, whether it's a citizen or local government leader or what have you, how would you suggest they get started down this path?
That is a great question. I think there's a lot of different things you could do. I would say one of the first things to do is just establish a goal. Figure out where you want to be and when you want to get there. And then you will have a goal you can work toward. That's one good step. Another good step is just to do some sort of benchmarking. Understand how much energy does the city use? How much energy do all of our businesses use? How much water do we use? How many gallons of fuel do we purchase for our fleet? So understanding where you're at, once you are really measuring what your usage is, you can then make a plan to reduce it.
Of course, these emissions and climate change are a global issue, and we see wrangling about it on the international stage, back and forth in national government here in the United States as well. What do you see as the value of a local government, a municipality in this case, taking climate action?
Yeah, Rob, that's a great question. And to be honest, local governments are on the front line for fighting climate change. It's truly up to us, kind of at the grassroots level, to drive changes in our own communities. The state governments and federal governments, they have resources for us, they have dollars for us, they have their own broader plans, but it's up to us to really, you know, change the needle in terms of where we're going. So I think that as a local government, we are driving change, but then we're also inspiring other municipalities to follow suit. So we're decarbonizing ourselves, but we're also creating a framework that others can follow if they want to decarbonize too. We're laying the groundwork. And then I think more importantly is we're inspiring our community members and our businesses to join us in this journey to a sustainable future. So I think that local governments really have a lot of influence in this space.
Rose, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Rose Daly is the Sustainability and Resilience Manager for the City of Sun Prairie. She was with us to share how Sun Prairie reached 100% sustainable electricity for city services. We're learning more about how Wisconsin municipalities are combating climate change. Now we turn to the City of Beloit, which is currently taking public input for its own climate action plan. Jerry Gabrielados is the City Manager for Beloit. And Ted Redmond is the co-founder of the sustainability company Pale Blue Dot, which is working with the City of Beloit on the project. Jerry and Ted, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Now, Jerry, you're at an early stage in this process. I understand. What led the City of Beloit to start planning a climate action plan?
Sustainability is a core tenet of the council's strategic plan. And within that, there's environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and social sustainability. And during the 2 years that I've been here, we've taken on parts of that. But this plan is really a way to kind of tie everything together, probably a little bit most related to the environmental sustainability aspect of that whole core, but critical that we get started in this work.
Ted, your company is working with Beloit. You've worked with a number of cities on sustainability and climate action plans. What kind of things do you suggest for a city like Beloit that's in these early stages?
Well, so, yeah, we have done a lot of these projects, and we always start off the projects doing pretty extensive community-specific research. So, you know, we want to do our greenhouse gas inventory assessment, vulnerability assessment. We look at ground cover conditions. We look at vulnerable populations, renewable energy potential. And once we're done doing all of that baseline assessment and data gathering, At that point in time, we then come forth with some preliminary, we call them starter goals, because I like to emphasize that it's just a place to start the conversation. Because once we get to that point, we get into a very collaborative, I call it a co-authoring planning process, where we get to get a large team together of community volunteers and city staff and others, and we go through a facilitated process together to come up with the specific ideas that we want in the plan.
Jerry, Ted mentioned partnering with community members. What kind of outreach are you doing to the public at this point to get their input and get people on board?
Sure. So about a month ago, we reached out to the community and asked people to apply to be part of our climate action team. We're in the midst of reviewing those applications, as well as gathering all the data that Ted has politely requested for us to take this project to the next stage. I will say, too, during the couple years that I've been here, that I've heard from community members about the importance of this work and what it means to them. Specifically, the League of Women Voters has brought this to our council, as well as me directly, to get this work underway. And that organization is probably 50 people strong. So the community is pretty well engaged.
And Ted, how important is it for a community to have some of that public buy-in and have people in the community at the table throughout this kind of sustainability planning process?
Well, it's crucial, and it depends on what type of plan you're doing, how I might answer why it's crucial. Some cities will do a climate action plan or an energy plan that's focused explicitly on municipal operations, in which case, engaging the public is very important because it's important for governments to be open and transparent with their community so that they know what's going on. And certainly they can collect input to figure out how to make the plan better. But when we're talking about a plan like Beloit's, which is both municipal operations and how can we help create the environment for community members, local businesses to also step into some of these changes and benefit from some coordination and collaboration, it becomes crucial to make sure that we're involving community members as deeply as we can, because the city can't do all of that work all by itself. What we're really talking about is how can we promote, educate, inform, provide access to information? What can we do to set up the environment, as I say? So you have to have people from the community engaged in that process, because they're the ones ultimately that are really going to be doing this in their homes and their businesses, not just the city. So that's why our approach, we always take a very collaborative plan creation approach, where I think of it as less that we Pale Blue Dot are creating and writing the plan, and more that we're facilitating it with a large group of co-authors.
We're talking about Wisconsin cities forming climate action plans. Our guests are Beloit City Manager Jerry Gabrielados and Pale Blue Dot co-founder Ted Redmond. His company's consulting on this with Beloit. Jerry, what kind of steps has Beloit already taken when it comes to sustainability?
Yeah, you know, you heard Sun Prairie talk about denser development. Last year, we undertook a comp plan. And as part of that, one of the goals was to create denser developments in our city over the next 20 years. The next part of that work, if you will be a rewrite of our zoning code to match the ambitious goals that are identified in the comp plan, to bring denser development so that people aren't traveling as far as they are now. Maybe they'll walk or bike to bring that dense development and reduce our emissions. In addition to that, we also just converted a position within the city as an organization. So we had an emergency manager, and given all the work that she does and its relation to weather emergencies, she's taken on a critical role with helping us in terms of climate and resiliency. So her name's Patty Miller. She will be alongside me and Ted for this ride.
Ted, you both mentioned this idea of, you know, shortening the amount of driving time that people have to do to get from home to work to business, whatever the case may be. In some cases, you're pushing back against decades and decades of development in different patterns. How do you start to move the needle on that when it's taken so much time to evolve the way it is now?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's actually one of the most challenging aspects of climate action. There's a number of things that we can do. First of all, just what can we do to encourage people to think about other modes of transportation, so walking, biking. And of course, that means, you know, from a municipal standpoint, we can do some things to help encourage that. How do we make sure that all of the streets that we build are complete, that provide support for different modes of transportation? So rather than building streets that take care of car traffic just fine, but say don't have any sidewalks, how can we make sure that we include sidewalks, think of bike lanes, or how bikes or walkers intersect with vehicles at intersections, et cetera. We can also make sure that we're talking or working with our public transit systems to increase accessibility, make sure that the routes are as effective as possible and getting people to where they need to go efficiently. We can also do things like, you know, explore how might we encourage or support remote working.
Jerry, these changes are not something where you flip a switch and they take effect tomorrow. What kind of time horizon are you planning on here?
So I think the actual plan will probably take us through December to complete. But when I review a fair amount of the pre-work that we're required to do as part of this, we've already started a lot of it. So I think, you know, addressing this crisis is something that will take a lifetime. But in the immediate term, we're already starting to chip away. We've added miles of bike lanes. We're creating better intersections. The city's more bike and pedestrian friendly already.
We'll leave it there. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Ted, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jerry Gabrielatos is the city manager of Beloit. Ted Redmond is the co-founder of the climate action planning firm Pale Blue Dot. They're with us to talk about how Wisconsin cities are creating climate action plans to promote environmental sustainability at the local level. Earlier, we heard from Rose Daly, sustainability and resilience manager for Sun Prairie.
Coming up, LaCrosse now allows smaller housing options on existing residential lots. Find out why and meet two winners of a city design award.
A design like this can fit in with all sorts of different types of circumstances. Just because it's a small residence doesn't mean that it's not going to be a good residence.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In western Wisconsin, residents are looking to an online library for affordable housing ideas.
Last year, the city of La Crosse passed an ordinance to allow separate housing units to exist on the same lot as an existing home. They're called accessory dwelling units, or ADUs for short.
One goal is to boost housing availability in the community. Lewis Kuhlman is the environmental and sustainability planner for La Crosse. Lewis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For people not familiar with this concept, what do we mean when we say accessory dwelling unit?
Well, it's like a smaller house in your backyard in place of a detached garage. It's typically called a backyard cottage or a granny flat or an in-law unit, but it's basically just a smaller house in your backyard.
The city of La Crosse passed this ordinance to allow more flexibility on accessory dwelling units. This is last year. What are the hopes for this? What are the goals when it comes to housing in the city?
There's a lot of demand for housing in La Crosse, as there is across Wisconsin. And we're really geographically limited by the Mississippi River and the bluffs, the river bluffs around the city. So in terms of growth, we really have to focus inward. And we're doing a lot of work on infill development, but in terms of how to add housing to our neighborhoods, one of the things we're looking at is accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, because they are able to kind of subtly blend in with the rest of the neighborhood. You're not going to see a dramatic skyscraper or even, like a sort of five-story box pop up on your block. It's just something that's on the backside of the home facing an alley that's really going to blend in with the rest of the neighborhood.
As part of this effort, you have this design competition to help come up with ideas, encourage people to check out this idea. We'll hear from a couple of the winners of that competition in just a few minutes. Can you talk about the competition and this library of accessory dwelling unit options you are developing there?
Yeah, it was a really exciting process. We were able to get a grant through the AARP's Community Challenge and partnered with the Wisconsin chapter of the American Institute of Architects to promote the challenge. So we got a number of submissions from across the state and even from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. We were really excited to get different ideas that were specific to La Crosse's zoning requirements, but also that we could incorporate into Wisconsin's building code. Because Wisconsin has a different building code than our surrounding states, so we have different challenges. So it was a really good opportunity for us to come up with design ideas that could be used in La Crosse and hopefully be an inspiration for accessory dwelling units across the state.
Who is your target audience for this? What kind of property owner do you think might be especially interested or benefit from adding an accessory dwelling unit?
Since this was a AARP grant, we were really thinking about our elderly folks and sort of retirees looking to downsize. This is kind of an opportunity for people who want to stay in the neighborhood but don't need all the space that their house currently has. They can sort of move into a smaller cottage in their backyard, so stay in the neighborhood and generate additional revenue if they want to by renting out their main unit. That's one option. Another potential target is just families that are trying to care for an elderly relative who could potentially move into the ADU. So there's a lot of opportunities for sort of intergenerational living. For both elder care and child care is another option. And of course, as a college town, we're always looking for opportunities for college students and young professionals to transition out of dormitory living in sort of more of a neighborhood.
One part of the story, if we're doing new construction, well, we might need to go to a bank and get a loan for it. Do you see financial and mortgage institutions being ready to say, oh, yeah, this is something we can work with, as opposed to this is alien to everything we do?
This is a new concept in La Crosse, but it's been used for, many decades and has grown more in popularity in the last decade or more. So I think more financial institutions are getting wise to accessory dwelling units as a housing potential. So that's some outreach that we need to do. We've laid the groundwork with allowing ADUs, and we've got our library to show examples of ADUs. Now we need to make sure that the financing is in place. One of the responsibilities of the city is to, make it as easy as possible if we're trying to see growth in this area.
As we wind up, Lewis, are you getting requests for permits for these ADUs now that this ordinance is in place?
Yeah, actually, in years prior to having our ordinance, we'd get questions, a couple times a year about the potential of having ADUs. And now that we allow them, we're getting more and more questions about it and developing concepts and testing the limits of our requirements and seeing what works and what doesn't. I think we're hoping to see some growth in this area. It's going to be small and may not be for everybody, but it's a really exciting opportunity to add more housing to our city.
Lewis, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Lewis Coleman, the environmental and sustainability planner for the city of La Crosse. We're talking about a new online database focused on sustainable housing ideas. Joining us now are Matt Bryan, a Wisconsin certified architect based in La Crosse. We also have project manager Jacob Bielanski of a Milwaukee architectural firm. They are winners of La Crosse's design competition. Jacob, let's start with you. What was on your mind?
Well, Milwaukee, which is where I'm based out of, has been working on its plan, Growth MKE. And as we've encountered a lot of the different discussions about people's concerns, as well as people's hopes and dreams in this, we saw La Crosse as a great opportunity to engage with another different municipality and also just kind of share ideas and cross-pollinate.
And how about you, Matt?
Yeah, you know, here in La Crosse, accessory dwellings are a pretty new idea. And so there's a lot of initial enthusiasm. And it just so happens that my interest also is in smaller projects like this. So that I see a lot of design opportunity within very small constraints, small footprints, and just a lot of potential for some really diverse solutions.
And Matt, let's start with how you solved this this challenge. A German concept, I understand, called the Wonder Hut. Talk us through this.
Yeah, you know, the idea in some ways was pretty playful, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but the essence of it is pretty simple in that it's a small footprint, about 500, 600 square feet, split into two rooms that share a bathroom. And with that much laid out, you know, beyond that, the potentials for how to use it are very much open-ended. That's where the wonder piece comes in terms of a wide range of possibilities for how you might choose to occupy it. It might be somewhere you live, somewhere one of your relatives lives. It might be a room for your kids. It might be a room for you, an office for you.
And then, Jacob, your take on converting an existing garage, as I understand it, into a guest house. Talk us through how you met this challenge.
Yeah, so we had an existing project in our company portfolio with Van Cleve Architects that had converted a existing garage into a guest house. And the plan was readily adaptable to accessibility. And in our minds, doing less is just a fundamental piece of sustainability. And so we wanted to show how we can reuse existing infrastructure. And at our presentation in La Crosse, also wanted to focus on this overall site design and how this integrates with neighboring properties, because a lot of concerns that people have about ADUs in higher density housing has to do with preserving neighborhood character and fabric, also integrating in a good way.
And Matt, with that in mind, I looked on the map. So the city of La Crosse offered a particular site in La Crosse, a lot sort of south of downtown a little bit. Were you thinking, okay, how do we fit into this particular neighborhood?
Yeah, great question. The short answer is I was not looking at this particular site, but this particular site happens to be emblematic of a lot of sites in La Crosse. It's served not only by a main road, but also by an alley on the backside. And that alone opens up a lot of opportunity. La Crosse is a very well-suited city for accessory dwellings in that sense, where you could potentially have an accessory dwelling primarily served by an alley and a main house primarily served by a main road. And each could have their own entrance in a sense. So,
and Jacob, that's interesting. Coming from Milwaukee, is there a difference in your mind in designing an accessory dwelling unit in La Crosse versus Milwaukee? Or on the other hand, I've been to Milwaukee. There's a lot of alleys there too.
Yep, that sure is. And it really depends on where you are in Milwaukee, because the different zoning areas that we have here produce neighborhoods of very different character and also different types of situations you have to build around. And a lot of times architecture winds up being a lot like tailoring. Everything is very specific, trying to meet people's needs. And our approach took what was there at the lot and just wanted to show different strategies as to how it might relate to this property in a way that could be adaptable to other ones, because La Crosse's adopted ordinances allow for many different types of construction in terms of it being a detached ADU, being an attached ADU to the main house, or even a second story addition to a garage. With our reuse of a garage, another component is that we fit our whole floor plan into a 450 square foot piece, which is a pretty average size for garage properties. So we wanted to show that a design like this can fit in with all sorts of different types of circumstances, and that just because it's a small residence doesn't mean that it's not going to be a good residence.
Now, both of your designs and some of the other competitors are going to be in this library of accessory dwelling unit designs in La Crosse. Jacob, let's start with you. What are your hopes for how people use these designs, your design and others, and how they can maybe adapt them to meet, you know, the particularities of the lot that they're being built in?
Well, it's less about the exact design and more about many of the principles. So we talked extensively at the hearing about just being a good neighbor, considering that this is going to be somebody that's living in this dwelling, and we really need to treat this with care and not just try to prop up as much as we can to help housing, which is very necessary, but like all things, needs to be handled with some discern. We wanted to show different ways that this can be accessible, and that accessibility isn't just something for a particular demographic or people in certain points of their life. It's something that makes for just comfortable design. Broadly speaking, there are dozens of different ways that these could be planned and designed to fit people's needs. Matt's is a great example of it. It's a fantastic design. But no two people are alike, and we just wanted to show and provide evidence that it's affordable, feasible, and better than I think connotations commonly will try to argue.
Matt, have you gotten any local interest since the contest and your design went up online?
I've had a couple people reach out. Some are still ongoing projects or in the early stages. One of them actually is someone who has an old playhouse in their backyard. So similar to the garage adaptation idea, there's the potential there to adapt a playhouse for an accessory dwelling use.
Jacob, we hear a lot about high housing costs in Wisconsin. That's part of what this ADU issue is helping to tackle. And high costs of construction in Wisconsin and materials and labor and more. Do you have that in mind as you're thinking about how to make accessory dwelling units not just functional, but affordable to build in the first place?
Absolutely. That was one of the main reasons that we chose to reuse the existing garage, which was ironically enough counter to the prompt. We were supposed to ignore it, but I think that a compromise like that is a very real situation that a lot of people will face, that you have something that you can use, and it might be the difference between doing it or not doing it. You know, here in Milwaukee, we also have a lot of similar issues with, obviously, with everything you mentioned, labor, materials, and maybe a bit more so here than in La Crosse, but also with land scarcity. But we have a lot of single family properties, and ADUs, once again, here provide another option in our tool belt for helping promote more dwelling units in the city.
And Matt, you're there in La Crosse. This ADU ordinance is still pretty new, this design contest hoping to kick things off. Do you feel a sense of momentum that there is interest and impetus in making these things a reality?
I do. You know, working in the architecture community, but also just talking to friends and family casually who have all kinds of dreams for what they could do with their backyard, anything from a garden to an ADU. And those things aren't mutually incompatible. You know, there's, I think, the dream of building a backyard kind of oasis, if you will, is something that's a really widespread dream for a lot of people. And I think there could be a ripple effect where one neighbor sees something going on next door, an ADU going up. They see how successful that is, how much fun that is to have. And then I could see it spreading its enthusiasm that way.
We'll leave it there. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It's been a dream to be on public radio. Thanks for having me.
And Jacob, thanks for joining us.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about accessory dwelling units with Wisconsin architects Matt Bryan and Jacob Bielanski. We also heard from Lewis Kuhlman, the environmental and sustainability planner for the city of La Crosse.
Yesterday on the show, we invited you to share your best thrift store and garage sale finds.
Marjorie in Green Bay emails, years ago, my husband found a beautiful, large, uniquely shaped, dark wooden serving bowl at the wonderful St. Vincent de Paul on Willie Street in Madison. When he brought it home, it looked so huge and was so heavy, I thought it was something we would rarely use.
Marjorie goes on, turns out I was wrong. We have used that wooden bowl on almost every family holiday, get-together, and occasion to celebrate. Most often, we use it to make salads as a bowl filled. It can serve 20 people or more. So many people have commented on the beautiful bowl. Where did we get it? It's so unique.
Thanks for the story, Marjorie. How about you? Share your best ever thrift store or garage sale score. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.